Hello, my name is Chris Malmberg, and I am here with my co-hosts, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. We'd like to welcome you to the Book Spider Podcast, a lit analysis podcast that overtly tries to draw connections between the books we've read most recently to create a metaphorical web of learning, and covertly gives three old friends the opportunity to stay connected over a literal web platform in a kind of abstraction of the conversations they used to have while in grad school. Today, we're discussing Martin Dressler, The Tale of an American Dreamer, by Stephen Milhauser. Martin Dressler follows the title character as he comes of age in a surging 19th century New York City, from a mere assistant to his father in a tiny cigar shop to a visionary hotelier. His path up is scaffolded by increasingly complex designs for how to capture the dreams of customers in increasingly elaborate and eventually magical hotels, until finally his hotels are so large and complex that their impossibilities push the book into light magical realism. His final hotel, the Grand Cosmo, is a financial failure, plunging him from meteoric success to ruin. Paralleling the story of his rise and fall is the story of his evolving and then failing relationship to several women, most notably the Vernons, two daughters and their mother. He marries one daughter, remote, dreamlike Caroline, but seems closer to the other, ambitious and bright Emmeline, who is a kind of business partner to him. It's increasingly unclear to Martin which sister he is more drawn to, and who he should be more drawn to, and what draws him, until his relationship to all three suddenly seems to evaporate, like all his money. All that sounds like a bit of a downer, but the novel ends on a kind of high note, with Martin looking forward to the next chapter in his life. So, Hans and Patrick, what did you think of Martin Dressler?
I thought the relationship between the Vernon women was super interesting. Like, you know, why does Martin want the distant, remote Caroline when he seems to have a much stronger connection with Emmeline? You know, so I thought that to me was the most interesting part of the novel. You know, whatever the novel is saying about the American dream or about capitalism or anything else felt opaque to me. So I'm kind of interested in what your guys' thoughts are on that. But I definitely, definitely thought that his relationship with women was an intriguing aspect of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, I liked it. I don't know that I was quite as transported by it as maybe I would have expected to be. And I don't know, I mean, why that is, I'm not totally sure. I mean, it did seem, you know, the characters are all, well, the characters feel reasonably full and alive and have some sense of depth. And it's certainly, you know, it's thematically fairly rich and ambiguous and has some, it's well crafted, right? It's good. I don't know, just at the purest level of kind of personal response, I liked it, but I did not love it. But I liked it a pretty fair amount. I can't really think of anything to impeach or criticize about it, right? I don't know if the... It's interesting, Patrick, that you you mentioned the his issues with women and the relationship between him and the two sisters and the mother, maybe to a lesser extent. I felt less... That part of it felt to me like it maybe kind of fizzled ultimately, right? And I mean, I think it was thematically important, but maybe dramatically didn't achieve any kind of resolution other than kind of just sort of fading like falling snow, right? Which is the central metaphor of the end of the novel, right? Is, you know, things that melt away like, you know, fallen snow on hot pavement, right? And that ultimately everything melts away like new fallen snow on warm pavement. And so, but it did feel like there's a way in which, you know, Caroline, his kind of distant, mysterious wife, Caroline, is, she poses a question as a character that isn't ever really answered. And it's thematically important that it's not answered, I suppose. And obviously, right, like his central quality of being kind of drawn to this unreachable, mysterious person and feeling warmth but not passion for this approachable, friendly person that he connects with. That's, you know, that makes a lot of thematic sense and is, I think, emblematic of a real kind of aspect of human psychology, right? The kind of, you know, the question, I've seen lots and lots and lots of, you know, I'm processing this mainly in a male way, but I'm sure it could be, there's a version of it that reflects the female experience, right? But I happen to process it in a male way based on history, but I've had lots and lots of friends who've said, okay, well, you know, I am in love with this distant, unreachable woman, and I like this other woman, but I can't bring myself to feel passion for her, right? And that's just kind of a common problem of being a single man of a certain age. And it captures that dilemma well, but then ultimately the fact that it captures that dilemma well works thematically, but the dramatic resolution of that dilemma kind of it doesn't really do much unless it's doing something that I missed, you know? Kind of a meandering response there, I guess, but like, maybe I'm just saying that in response to, you know, to Patrick's observation that he found that aspect of it the most interesting. And I went all over the place there, guys. Sorry about that.
No worries. Yeah, you know, this is the second time that I've read this, and I found the relationships to be more rich with how they seem to intersect with, I think, peculiarities of Martin Dressler as a character, his own way of seeing the world, and how that may reinforce his attraction to someone so remote and mysterious as Caroline. And while it does sort of also map onto lived experiences, as Hans says, I also was a little bit disappointed. I'd forgotten how that wrapped up with the sisters. And I got really excited with this, because I'd forgotten, with Caroline's retreat into Emmeline's care, and then pushing Emmeline into Martin's orbit, into their home, and Martin's sort of direct appreciation of the symbology of that, and then how it played out felt ambiguous. It felt climactic and ambiguous, but not resonant. Like it didn't work for me. Like it was Caroline marches into the apartment with Martin and her sister there. They haven't, I don't believe, had sex or done anything inappropriate. Martin's actually sort of frustrated with Emmeline for not seeing that this is clearly what they're supposed to do. And Caroline tries to shoot her sister, but shoots a hole in the ceiling because she's a fainting lady. I'm not sure. I didn't know what to do with it, and it didn't seem to charge anything interesting thematically with me. It's like there's a useful ambiguity, and then there's the ambiguity for the sake of ambiguity, and it felt like the latter to me, being critical. I also like this book. I like this book a decent amount. I second time through, I think it's very, very well crafted, as you say, Hans, and interesting, and it has a very high floor and a slightly higher ceiling, and it's just a really good book. But moving on to some questions that I had. So this is following Road Song, and I chose it after Road Song because I remembered it as a book in which people are building. It's very place-based, like Road Song. In this case, it's set in New York at a very specific time. Road Song was set in Alaska at a very specific time. And also because the family in Road Song, in my mind, was sort of running away from the systems and processes that were developing in modern America that seemed to be nascent in this novel, seemed to be kind of growing in this novel, that Martin Dressler is taking part in helping to grow and helping to build. But I also, in reading this, just was blown away by how I hadn't recognized how resonant it could be with High Rise. So I kind of have questions about both, connections about both with both novels. But we'll start with Road Song. And I'm curious what you guys see in this world we see coming into being in Martin Dressler. It's a world of assimilating systems and materiality and commodification, of massive visionary projects and endless expansion. And how does that world like compare to Cush's world that she sort of paints, this setting in Alaska in the 60s that's so very different? And because I think both are stories about America, I'm curious if it's possible to talk about them in a productive way. And it might not be possible. It might be that this is just comparing two unlike things. But I'm curious about your thoughts about that.
Well, I think that one thing that leaps out to me is the question of economic mobility or class mobility, right? I mean, Martin Dressler not that he comes from a family of totally limited means, right? But he, through a particular kind of basically instinctive skill set, he's able to go from being maybe lower struggling middle class to fantastically wealthy, right? And in a slightly different version of this, you can imagine him essentially creating a dynasty of family wealth, right? I mean, if he were a little saner and a little more linear in his interests and desires, this could be the story of like the beginning of, you know, the Hilton family, right? Or the Waltons or something. And social and class mobility seem to occur with great fluidity here, right? At least in the instance of this individual. Whereas, you know, when we talked about the memoir Road Song by Natalie Cush, which was our pick for last week, for those who didn't listen to last episode of the show, when we talked about the memoir Road Song by Natalie Cush, one thing that we came back to a lot, I think, was the sense of, you know, when Cush's family moves to Alaska, it seems like part of what they're running away from is the impossibility of economic mobility, right? Or the impossibility of, the impossibility of advancing beyond a place where they have to struggle and struggle and struggle for basic survival. And I mean, you know, consciously or not, they go to a place where they have to struggle even harder for basic survival. But I mean, Road Song is about people who work desperately as hard as they can to stay in one place on the economic ladder. And Martin Dressler is about someone who advances terrifically far up the economic ladder in a way that seems to, it's not that there's no effort, but the effort is so instinctive and pleasurable that it barely registers as effort, right? It's the story of someone who, as a question of character, happens to be very well suited to succeed in his environment. So there's a very interesting difference between the two there, I think, particularly because Martin Dressler is the son of immigrants from Germany and Natalie Cush is the daughter of immigrants from, I don't think specifically Germany, but somewhere else in Europe.
Poland.
Right? So there's Poland, right? So there's they're beginning actually from very similar places in that regard.
Yeah, Martin Dressler speaks of favorable forces, I think is the term he uses. He feels himself buoyed up. And it seems as though his particular dream, his aesthetic inclinations just happen to align with what is desired by New York at this specific time. And at the end, yeah, he reconciles himself to the fact that that was never going to be forever. That even the hotels that he created before the Grand Cosmo, which were marvelously successful, will one day be forgotten. They will one day be old and left behind. And his success then is something that is mysterious. It's something that, you know, might as well have happened to somebody else.
So in that sense, maybe they are actually very similar thematic works, right? They're about kind of the arbitrariness of, and maybe this is a stretch to say, but is it accurate to say then that Road Song and Martin Dressler to some extent are both kind of about the arbitrariness of success or failure in a capitalist system? Maybe that's such a reduction that it kind of, you know, like maybe that's kind of like squashing the beauty of both those books to reduce them in that manner.
Well, I think I like how what you're saying reminds me of what Cush's family finds in Fairbanks, which is not described as a dream. I don't think it's ever described as a dream. Martin Dressler, he uses the kind of the concept, the idea of dreaming as a kind of a canvas on which people's desires are captured or broadcasted. And then in his case, mined for developing different products or services that feed back into those dreams. So basically New York in this like massive growth, but this place of this time of verdant growth and change, the people, the capitalism is able to very quickly take what people want and give it back to them. And he has just a knack, a vision for what those things might be. And so he belongs to this place, to this kind of shared dream of what New York should be. And it is something that makes him comfortable in that place. And Cush and her family seek a dream. Really, they have a dream about what Fairbanks could or should be before they've ever been there, in a way that kind of feels alien today with air travel and stuff like that. But they get into a car without really, you know, doing that much research and go on a very challenging road trip just to get to this place where they feel like they will belong, because they feel like, using the terms from, you know, from this book, Martin Dressler, like the dream there will welcome them. So I mentioned that this also seemed to resonate with a book that we read earlier, High Rise by J.G. Ballard. In High Rise by Ballard, a high rise is the setting for that novel, and the high rise is developed and designed and built by an architect, the owner of the building, to basically cater to the needs of all of its occupants. That premise basically sets up a devolution in those tenants who cease to want to leave the high rise and feel connected to the high rise in a way that supplants their connection to the outside world. They do not leave that high rise, and in some sense, that dooms both them and the high rise together. That is kind of interesting because it's connected thematically to the grand Cosmo that Martin Dressler builds, and it's his greatest work, but it's also his greatest failure. He builds it to contain entire psych wards with 200 patients, actors posing as patients, displaying different psychological conditions. There's parks inside and whole department stores. It is meant to not only capture everything that, you know, the tenants might pragmatically need, but also, I think, everything that they may dream of needing. And I'm curious because the Grand Cosmo is a cosmic failure. The people do not stay. So why is the Grand Cosmo a failure? How does the public's rejection of the Grand Cosmo differentiate it and this novel from the high rise in Ballard's novel, which the people cling to and stay in, dooming both them and the high rise? It seems like you could say that the high rise in Ballard's novel is successful in that the people stay, but actually I think mostly in that novel people talk about the high rise's failures. I think the principal distinction here is that the people in Ballard's novel stay in that high rise, whereas the people in Martin Dressler's novel, they don't stay. It's not a success.
I think part of that might have to do with, you know, you mentioned earlier the way in which Martin Dressler observes that he and his dreams happened to be, and I might be, you know, in paraphrase, I might be taking this awfully far from what it originally was, so feel free to correct how I'm characterizing this, but Martin Dressler observes that, like, he and his dreams were very well suited to a particular time, and the world moves on, right? And I think to some extent, like, the success and failure, the relative successes or failures of the Grand Cosmo versus the High Rise and High Rise are about the author's perception of the time that they're occurring in, right? The novel High Rise, the idea, I mean, there's as listeners of our High Rise episode may remember, there's a lot to be debated about the meaning of the novel High Rise or the High Rise in that novel. But, like, ultimately, the people stay in the high rise because the high rise allows them to kind of tap into some deeper, more authentic version of themselves that is ultimately characterized by regression into violence and anarchy in a particular sense of the word, right? Not the political sense, but just the sense of meaning chaos. And that, you know, the high rise occurs in a time when people find it socially satisfying to withdraw from the world into that kind of state of violence, right? And the grand Cosmo, I think, I'm not exactly sure how I'd characterize the spirit of that age, but the grand Cosmo represents something that New York moves away from, right? I think it's the ability to attract and retain tenants of the grand Cosmo versus Ballard's high rise, I think as much as anything has to do with their suitedness to their times, right? Martin Dressler is about someone whose ambitions ultimately come to a mismatch with the world he's dreaming of. And high rise is about a project whose ambitions are maybe like almost too perfectly in line with the deep-seated desires of the people that it's catering to. Just in terms of like High Rise and Martin Dressler, one thing I think is interesting is that in the novel High Rise, there's a fixation on the levels above, the above ground levels, and how being at a particular level in the kind of upward vertical scale of the high rise translates to a particular kind of social status or tribe or whatever. And in Martin Dressler, the most interesting part is underground, right? As Martin expands his visions, he goes further and further. Part of his sense of expansion is putting more and more of the hotels underground. And much of the real kind of mystery of the grand Cosmo comes from, you know, what's down there, right? And so it's interesting to me that they, both of those buildings, their vertical dimensions are very important to their identity, but in High Rise that has to do with kind of moving upward, and in Martin Dressler that has to do with what's buried. And I think that's probably that difference is symbolically very meaningful, I think, though I don't know if I can articulate exactly how.
Sorry, I thought I was going to sneeze for a second. And you know, like, everything you're saying, Hans, is super interesting, and like, I feel like you make a good case. But my reaction to both High Rise and Martin Dressler, I think was somewhat different. So like the thing about High Rise is I don't know if the novel masquerades as a novel about class, or if like the marketing for the novel says it's about class when it's not really about class. But like when I you know, started reading High Rise, like my initial reaction is, oh, this is about class, this is like exploring the various tensions between, you know, different strata of society. But the more I read the novel, the more I felt like that reading was undermined by various factors. And when I read Martin Dressler, I start off, you know, this is like, I don't know, was this a part of an introduction or was this part of the novel itself where or maybe it was in the synopsis where, like, you know, the synopsis says this is the story of Martin Dressler, how, like, he rises up for a time but then doesn't anymore. And you get the sense that there's going to be this big downfall. And, you know, I don't know what – he doesn't necessarily have a personal downfall so much as, you know, his vision – isn't, you know, monetarily successful. And so what I'm trying to get at in my, you know, inept way is basically that both of these novels purport to be about something, whether it's due to factors outside the novel itself or just, you know, what my natural reading inclination is. Both of these novels purport to be about something related to capitalism, but ultimately, upon reading them, I'm uncertain of what their critique of capitalism is, or if they're a critique of capitalism at all, or if they're talking about class. So it feels to my mind, Hans, even though you're explaining it very well, it feels to my mind that there's more uncertainty, more ambiguity than we're allowing for.
I'd agree with that, actually, yeah. I think so.
Okay.
I think you're right.
I mean, I just don't know where I think this novel is well written. I think it's interesting. But, you know, like, if I were writing this novel, Martin would be a despicable person, right?
Is he? But that's the question. Is he? I mean, like,
I don't think he is. I don't think he's despicable. I mean, no. Despicable? No. Like, maybe he does the normal capitalist thing, which is exploit workers, which is something that is not good, but, like, he's not personally disgusting or, like, say, Donald Trump is, like, a personally nasty, disgusting human, you know? I wouldn't say, you know, and it's interesting because Trump is actually a hotelier as well, right?
Trump is dressed.
Albeit
Dressler
a less
would be very
imaginative
fa-
one, yeah.
very
that's
fascinating.
Right,
all what? The toilets are made out of gold. But
what'd you say, Hans?
I said, albeit a less imaginative one.
Right.
But Patrick, like, if doesn't it? This is kind of a craft question. If you're writing a critique of capitalism, if mm-hmm. the goal, a critique that is, that is attacking capitalism, that is looking to undermine capitalism, if that's the goal, doesn't it undermine itself if you are forced to turn the capitalists into villains? Aren't you trying to attack the system itself? Does Martin Dressler have to be personally villainous for the things that he's doing to be, you know, ultimately potentially not great for the system? And I'm not saying that that's this novel. I'm just kind of asking a
craft
question.
I think certainly you could write a novel that critiques capitalism without portraying a particular owner as personally disgusting. Certainly. But like to do that, we would, you know, we still need to see some of the features of capitalism that are shitty, and we don't, you know, like we don't see anything from anyone's perspective other than Martin's, right?
Right.
Like the whole novel is told through Martin's perspective, and so like we don't see the teeming mass of employees that he would have to run huge hotels who work, you know, 12, 16-hour days, and, like, they're mistreated by guests, they're paid a pittance compared to Martin. We don't see any of that.
We don't see the adorable family of rabbits who live on the grounds where they're going to build the Cosmo. And
right,
are,
exactly.
You know,
what's that from? Is that from anything?
I guess it was a riff on Watership Down, maybe. It's just a particular way of framing that kind
right,
of thing
right.
that would be, you know, kind of a cliched alternative.
Something similar happens in The Secret of Nim, where the but it doesn't have to do with agriculture and technology.
Right.
Where the mother mouse has to move her son who has pneumonia because her house is going to get destroyed by the combine machine of the farmer, you know. So it's definitely about the horrors of technology.
We should do a triptych of Watership Down, The Secret of Nim, And what's the third one? The one where the
Fantastic Mr. Fox?
No. It's one where a bunch of creatures, like forest creatures, get together and they make a flying machine to survive a pollution monster. It's also cool. A cartoon. Yeah. Yeah, there's
I've never heard of it, but
the late
'90s, cool.
Early aughts had a good run of them. But sorry, Patrick, you were going to say.
No, I just mean if this is a critique of capitalism, where is all of this other stuff? The novel just doesn't offer any other perspective than Martin's. So, I'm not really sure how we're supposed to read into this that, all I'm saying is, to me, it's totally indeterminate. I have no real clue thematically what this novel is about. And, I'm not sure that you've convinced me, Hans, that it's about all the things you're saying it's about, is all.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And I actually don't think that I think that it's interested in aspects of the nature of capitalism. I completely agree that it is not interested in any critique of those, I think, has to kind of be brought by the imagination of the reader, right?
Right.
Or any element of critique is very, very, very subtly framed. I'm trying to think of, there's a reference to, oh God, I can't remember her name. The maid, the hotel maid that he sleeps with
Marie.
On his wedding night. What?
Maria Haskova.
Maria Haskova. There's something there, right? There's something in the way in which she kind of casually uses Marie and then lets her slip out of his mind or treats her mainly as a symbol and comes back to where she used to work, naively thinking she'll still be there, and the hotel's not even there. It's all gone, right? I think if you want to read anything here as being critical, it's probably the way in which Marie is kind of casually used, discarded, and then, come back to far too late, right? Mm. And even that is fairly subtle. And I don't know. I think it is thematically about advertising and capitalism and the urge to kind of, the expansionist urge and the urge to take the whole world and kind of filter it into, what Martin's doing to some extent with the Grand Cosmo, he's trying to own the world, right? The world is all out there. It's all there. It's all available. If you all the wonders of the world are there. And rather than encourage people to go experience the world as it exists, his urge is to encapsulate it into a contained form that he can own, right? And that is I don't know that you need to be told explicitly that is a perverse urge, right? It seems obvious to me that is a perverse urge. And honestly, I think if the novel felt the need to tell us that were a perverse urge, it might be a bit obnoxious, I agree that there are lots of ways it could be much more overtly critical of capitalism that it is not, but I don't think it's totally void of, I think it's impossible not to see some perversity in aspects of how Martin relates to the world, right?
Well, okay. That's interesting. That's super interesting that like, certainly we could view, like, definitely the urge to own the world is a perverse urge. And I'm wondering if the book supports that reading or if it doesn't. And I don't want to, like, take charge, but I feel like I don't want to take charge of, like, the questions, Chris, but I feel like that could be tied into, like, the question about the magical realism at the end, and some of the, like, the more surreal aspects of the novel where, like, he dreams, like, this idea of dreaming. So I'm not going to, like I'm going to wait until we get to that part, but I think there might be something in that part to help us decide whether, like, we are meant to read him as perverse or not.
Let's get to that. And before we do, I just have one line that I find interesting because, you know, Patrick, you brought up kind of the strained relationship Martin has with Emmeline, Margaret, the mother, and Caroline, his wife.
Right.
And Hans, you mentioned his perverse desire to own the world, and it made me think of, you know, there's several issues with Martin that are I think fascinating in how strange they are, but then because we're kind of trapped in his perspective, I'm not sure that we, and it's not an unreliable narrator thing, it's more just kind of what we pay attention to. We pay attention to things. Like, we pay attention to almost a glut of detail about the colors of banners and the carved Indians and pilgrims on the outside of stores and what the you know, the ways in which things are painted or the ribbons in people's hair. And it's all very, very, very fixated on those sorts of details. And then other things are just very lightly glossed over. And I think there's room potentially to kind of read more into, you know, some of these details that Martin just doesn't pay attention to. And so we don't get a lot of, and I'm in my book, it's page 136. And it's, you know, the reason I went here is because he's interested in marrying Caroline, but he never actually proposes to Caroline. He's talking to Emmeline, who he has the much stronger relationship about whether or not Caroline might be interested in marrying him. And in effect, they're kind of engaged through Emmeline, which is sort of bizarre. But he's asking Emmeline if Caroline would marry him. And then he asks her, would it be good for me? Which is also a very bizarre question. And Emmeline, this is the next line. Oh, everything's good for you, Emmeline said harshly. And there's little things like that with Emmeline specifically that invite me to wonder a little bit about kind of the texture of his relationship to these women and how, I don't know, what different things that might be problematic about that. That we don't necessarily get too much detail about.
I mean, I think if nothing else, you know, going back to the question of whether anything here can be read as critical, he has a very good relationship with Emmeline, and maybe it defies categorization a little bit, but he has somebody he is close to and identifies with, and over the course of the novel, choices that he makes lead him to become isolated and alienated from that person, right? And that alienation is very connected to connected to his obsession with his work as a hotelier. So again, I mean, I think it's hard not to read that as It's maybe not, you know, there's not a big red flag put on it, right? But like the decay of his relationship to Emmeline, again, is suggestive to me of some level of critique of his way of behaving and being in the world.
So jumping to the end, and this is, Patrick, whenever you feel like you want to weigh in with your question, this novel reads, while it reads very stylistically, and there are flights of fancy throughout, it's really just in the last, you know, 40, 50 pages when the details begin to kind of lift out of what should be possible. Martin first updates the Vanderlyn Hotel, then he creates the Dressler, then the new Dressler, and then the Grand Cosmo. And with the Vanderlyn, it is mostly rooted in what seems to be possible in, you know, if you were to just insert different weird things into a building. With the Dressler, we start to get more fantastical ideas of what could be in a hotel. Not necessarily unrealistic, though. I'll jump to the new Dressler, where we get parks and a pond that you paddle to in a boat. I think in one of the hotels you have pyramids. It just starts to kind of break what should be possible, unless these are, I'll say, like, you know, the 200 actors who are each portraying different particular delusions is, I think, like a good example. And then finally the end, where, you know, Martin is living in the Grand Cosmo and filling it with actors who get to stay in free rooms so long as they act as though they're patrons, and then, you know, paying an actor to play himself, and then being drawn to three women actors who may or may not be actors, who are obviously resonating with the women who have been in his life this far. There's this kind of dream-like state, even if it isn't explicitly magical realism of the end, that feels, I don't think that it's jarring necessarily, but it definitely feels like something that is more overt at the end and is stylistically interesting to discuss. So I was curious about what you think about that ending. Do you think that Mühlhauser pulls it off, and kind of, you know, a craft sort of feedback question, sort of like, you know, your take on this, like if he handed you this draft, like, what would your feedback be about the ending in particular?
I think now that I liked it, I think. I actually appreciated the kind of reasonably gradual slip into what you might call a surrealist or magical realist register. I ultimately think I found that maybe more interesting and surprising than kind of Downfall into Misery, right? I mean, there's, you know, it's not Citizen Kane here, right? And it could have been. And I found that interesting, right? I guess part of maybe it'll probably be the thing that I remember the most in 5 years, actually, is kind of the way in which the idea of his hotels kind of gradually moves into the realm of the absurd and the surreal, and the particular image of him selecting an actor to portray himself and having that be the thing which allows him to remove himself from that context, right? Having that be the thing which allows him to cut off that part of himself in his life and, you know, step outside and look at the sky, right? I'm not sure that I've totally processed it thematically. And maybe this isn't, I don't know if this comparison is productive or distracting, but it was very hard for me not to think about, have either of you seen the movie Synecdoche, New York?
It just occurred, it occurred to me yesterday that they are very similar. The actor thing is
hiring an actor to play oneself in the giant recreation of the world that you've made in a warehouse, right? Very similar.
I haven't seen it.
Well, spoiler alert, I guess, if you ever do
see
it. But
it's all right.
I don't know that I have anything illuminating to say about that comparison, but it registered so strongly that it was very, very difficult for me not to, you know, bring it up because it colored. It's interesting though, because in Synecdoche, New York, that's kind of like one of the last steps toward a tragic undoing. And or just toward, you know, kind of the decay out of life, right? And in Martin Dressler, it's a I think that it is a positive step, right? It's a way of releasing himself from that, from kind of the ambitions of world building that he has in the grand cosmos. And I found that, I don't know if I can explain it thematically, but I did find it evocative and
I would say that the way you recapped it, Chris, makes me feel like it actually lends support to your reading, Hans. Like, you know, he realizes the grand cosmos is a financial failure. He's not ready to give up on his dream. He hires these actors. He lives in the grand cosmo, you know, and then so like the idea that, well, if the outer world isn't going to accept my dream, I will populate my dream with, you know, like actors so that I can believe it's real. Certainly would indicate some, like, a real perversion. But then, like, it does seem like hiring the actor to play himself, he extricates himself, and do we read the ending as hopeful? Like, maybe he's moving on from his desire to own the world. Or we don't read it anyway. Read it one way or the other.
It's probably, I mean, it's reasonably ambiguous, right? But just the fact that it's ambiguous is maybe ultimately helpful. The fact that he is not in that moment experiencing, if he is experiencing kind of an erasure of self, right? If he is experiencing, I don't know what the term is for it exactly, ontological anxiety, right? If he is experiencing an ontological crisis by giving up the dreams that have defined him, he doesn't seem unhappy or panicked, right? It seems like a peaceful release. Even though it's not explicitly stated that he has any clear idea what's next or that he's actively happy to be liberated, it does ultimately seem like a peaceful moment to have that liberation.
Right.
And if there is ontological erasure, it's not terrifying, right?
Right.
Well, that's it, everybody. That's Martin Dressler.
Puzzling.
It's puzzling, but I kind of feel like I like it and I want to do more with it in my brain. And I don't know what to do. As you say, Hans, he's just the last few lines. For the time being, he would just walk along, keeping a little out of the way of things, admiring the view. It was a warm day. He was in no hurry. It's very, I think, positive. But I don't know. I feel like, in a way, like, it's sort of like Martin, his characterization as this visionary creator of spaces is so encompassing that I don't know what replaces it. And so the character that walks, you know, out of the back of the novel is so completely reborn that I, if there is some substantive change, it's not like he had some girl in high school that he like shoved aside in order to, you know, make his mark on the world. And now he knows his lesson. He's going to go back and find her. She went to Fiji. I think that's a Truman reference, but a bad one. But I don't know what to do with it other than to feel like maybe he's in a better place. I just don't know what that place is. And I feel like that kind of like thing where it's like I get a general sense of the trajectory of where a theme may carry me or some kind of symbol or resonant bit of dialogue. I get this sense of where I might go with it, but I don't know where I would end. I don't know where to go with it with enough clarity to feel like I can untangle it. Yeah, I don't know. I think I hear you with, you know, this, you know, your frustration with the ambiguities in this novel. And I think I ultimately end up there, even if I do like it.
I think that I like it more having talked about it, actually. I think that when I finished reading it, there's something that I was hoping for out of Caroline that I never quite got. And I think at the time that I finished reading it, I was disappointed enough with that to not recognize other things that I found thought-provoking or engaging about it. Having talked about it a bit, I actually think I like it a fair amount. And I think that I do appreciate the subtlety of the theme and the need, I recognize, Patrick, what your perspective, that it could be much more overt in its critique. But I also feel like there are maybe enough comparable works that are overt in that critique that I'm okay with it doing a different thing.
See, I don't even know if that's what I want. If I want it to be more overt, but maybe I do. I usually always do. You're probably right.
I
always want it to be. I always want it to be 1984, hitting me right on the nose. That way, I can't misinterpret it. And that's my personal feeling.
A quick last question. Maybe this won't go anywhere. Is this about art? Is this about the artistic impulse?
No, you're wrong.
No,
not
there's
at all, you think?
No,
there's,
I don't know.
Yeah, there's some. I read a couple pieces about it. There's a lot of really inscrutable stuff about this novel. One article was about how this is showing the post-humanist tilt. Meaning that we, in post, again, this is the term that the author was using, that this was sort of human beings being replaced by abstractions of human beings, and that being like a different, not necessarily like capitalism, but like an aspect of it. I didn't really like that article, but there were several like that. There were just maybe people finding something to get published about something and not really producing anything very interesting. But there were a couple of takes on this as being about the artistic process, and Martin Dressler being a stand-in for Milhauser, and Milhauser being in the business of creating little worlds as a writer. Is that where you're going with that, Hans?
Pretty much, yeah. I guess I was thinking more about the kind of drive toward more and more and more, right? As an analog to kind of the artistic, there's probably a lot of really personal stuff coming into that, right? Because like I do music, and I've been the last couple years, like what I've been doing, I've been trying to make it more rich and complex in ways that involve dumping more and more money into it, and that is beginning to seem
so.
That's
true.
Really beginning to seem. I don't know how long that's going to be sustainable if somebody doesn't, help me out by giving me some money, right? And that's not at all, I certainly don't want to drill into that in the context of this podcast, but the aspect of the artistic impulse that has to do with kind of the voracious need to kind of evolve what you do, right? Or the perpetual dissatisfaction of the ambitious artist. But I mean, creating little worlds, obviously, that's a very apt way to describe one of the features of many different types of art making, certainly.
I like where you took that, though, with the investment part of it and the way that the act of creating draws so much from the person and is often an investment that doesn't pay back in the way that you hoped it would. And that is interesting. That hadn't occurred to me. You should write an article about it and get it published. It's definitely more coherent than a lot of the literature I read about this book. Was that
all right?
It?
Well, should I talk about my pick for?
Yeah, lay it down on us.
So I'll confess here to some extent to kind of, this is a book that I've been kind of thinking about picking for a while on and off, so I can't say that I'd be lying to say that it's explicitly just a reaction to Martin Dressler, but I do think that this is a book which is maybe in certain ways like an inverse or a mirror image of Martin Dressler, and that'll maybe make more sense once you've read it. I mean, it might be better if you read the book and then we come back to that than if I explain in detail how I think that is.
Sure.
But the book is Split Tooth by Tanya Tagok.
Split Tooth.
Split Tooth, yeah. And last name is spelled Tagaq, and I'll send that to you guys so you can find it. But yeah, Split Tooth by Tanya, and I may be mispronouncing her name. I looked it up ahead of time and then forgot. But Tanya Tagak or Tagok, I'll get it pinned down before next podcast.
Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll be seeing you next episode when we talk about Split Tooth.